This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I mean, I think it'd be a lot more of a gross misconduct if, you know, you were on the Fordham Dance Institute video grabbing your crotch.
That's a gray area for me, Chris. I don't know.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, a man who gave birth to Rinsanity, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike, how you doing, babe?
How'd you like that one?
That was clever. That was a little more sportsy than I always expect from
it. And I came up with it myself, right there. So what do you make of the Jeremy Lin stuff? I'm surprised you haven't blogged about it yet.
I'm so... It's the same reason I didn't blog about Tebow. It's just so cheesy. It's this overinflated kind of search for... It's like writing about Kim Kardashian.
Yeah. So do you think that guy should have gotten fired for the headline?
No. Chinks in the armor? Oh, my God. Are people not so hypersensitive? The guy loses his job for this?
I mean, do you think he even thought about it?
He may have. He probably thought it was like kind of funny. I mean, it was an online 3 a.m. ESPN for crying out loud. I mean,
come on, Rick. If people don't get fired for this, then what? Huh?
You can't say anything. This is bizarre.
I thought you're Mr. I want to fire everybody. Fire the teachers.
I want to fire people who actually do stuff wrong. I don't want to fire somebody for engaging in a, you know, display of slightly poor taste. Hell, Nicholas Kristof called New Haven Ground Zero as he was complimenting their ed reform.
Yeah,
I'd like to see the Times fire him. That strikes me as a very poor choice of words, especially for a New York City newspaper columnist.
Yeah,
but you know what? People have got to get over themselves a little.
You know,
bit.
There was a great Atlantic Monthly blog post on the Wire blog talking about other uses of phrase words that you should avoid, but even if you don't know about it. So, for example, referring to the peanut gallery. Especially in reference to the president. Not good, because I guess once upon a time, the peanut gallery was where African Americans had to sit back in the days. Again, I have no idea about that. So, anyways, yes, you are not allowed to use chinks in the armor. No play on words with those kinds of Asian.
Well, wasn't a aide to like Mayor Williams fired a number of years ago for using niggardly or something?
Right.
You know, yes. So now you not only can't use... Right, you can't use words that you know that are you know distasteful, but strikes me as hardly you know insanely malicious.
Yeah.
But you can't even use perfectly legitimate words because somebody else who has a dubious you know who has a dubious understanding of the English vocabulary, you know, might take offense.
We need to ask Diane Ravitch how she feels about this because she wrote that great book, The Language Police, several years ago about this sort of thing. I wonder now with her turnaround and her new friends, like how she'd feel. We'll ask her about the chinks in the armor thing. Okay, lots to cover today. You might not know that from all our bantering, but there is stuff going on in the education reform world.
Wow.
Rick's excited. Rick's here. Rick Hess in the house. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly. Ty, kick us off.
The Washington Post recently reported that the U.S. has many job openings in manufacturing, but struggles to find applicants with the technical skills to fill them. Do we need to revive vocational education programs?
Yes.
You know, I mean, in the Post piece, one of the great pieces, I was talking to some guys at Boeing or something out of Washington, and they're like, look, you know, a huge part of the problem is you've got all of these Americans who don't want to get their hands dirty. Everybody wants to work at places like Fordham and AEI or public school office, and the guys on the assembly floor actually make more than these mid-level kind of white-collar guys. But you know what? If you watch TV, if you go to movies, if you listen to music, if you read, you don't see a whole lot of attention being paid to how cool it is to actually put on overalls and get your hands dirty.
Yeah, and make something.
Make something.
Yeah. I mean, look, we've talked about this a little bit. I think the pendulum is swinging here. You know, a few years ago, we were all into the college for all mania and, you know, pushed by Education Trust and some others. I can't help. I always blame Education Trust for everything.
They deserve it.
Well, and, you know, that it was racist to talk about vocational education because the worry was that we're going to just push all the minority kids into that. Look, we need vocational education. It should not be something that we push kids into. It should be something that we say, hey, this is a real option for people. Give everyone a strong grounding in K to 8 in high school. If some kids want to go a more vocational route, let's make it happen and let's make those programs something that are useful and not teaching hairdressing.
But also, I mean, I think, again, a lot of it is about the center of cultural gravity. I mean, if we look at the schools that get talked about in the popular imagination, you know, the Thomas Jefferson right here, or, you know, the Kipps and the Yeses and Achievement First. Very few of them actually give you give even a show of respect for people who do jobs that get their hands dirty every day.
Oh, yeah, I know. I mean, everything in the school reform movement is about getting more minority kids into college. And again, and I agree. And look, that's a hugely important thing, and we've got a long way to go in that, particularly if the Supreme Court decides to get rid of affirmative action. You know, that's going to be even more important. But there's this other piece, too, that gets very little attention, which are schools that are preparing kids for very good paying jobs, satisfying lives, et cetera, that are not about office jobs.
But again, that's right. I mean, so there's two things going on. One is there's this question of, should we do a better job of providing this kind of preparation? Sure, of course we should, in higher ed and K-12 for as many people as possible. But the other thing is really a cultural question, which we have gotten, you know, it's part of, again, reading and math score mania. That everything in education is getting boiled down to a couple of simple metrics and the notion that you're successful if more kids go to college. And until we actually start to say that, you know what, the world's a big, complicated place and there's lots of ways to succeed and excel, we're going to be, you know, we're going to be fighting our way uphill.
All right, Ty, topic number two. Now we're talking about Winsanity, waiver insanity.
The deadline for states to submit applications for the second round of NCLB waivers is less than a week away, and many appear poised to apply. Are they making a mistake, or is it worth accepting the Department of Education's conditions to get free of NCLB?
So, free of NCLB, if only. Look, it's going to be interesting to see how many states back out. We've already had a couple say, hey, no thanks, but no thanks on the waivers that were planning to apply before the first round was announced. Rick, you haven't been on the show since the waiver stuff came down. I mean, my sense was the states asked for a mile, the department gave them an inch, and very little flexibility handed out in the end. What's your take?
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole thing's a crock. It shows why I have become so profoundly uncomfortable with either conversation of waivers or the secretary's discretion when it comes to education. So look, states are still going to do it because the one thing it does let you get out of is identifying as 60 or 70% of your schools is failing in 2014. And if you're a governor, that actually counts for a hell of a lot. And you'll trade off a lot. But I've talked to a couple of state chiefs who got the waivers through round one who felt that they were misled back in September, that Duncan made broad promises and the department staff didn't come anywhere close to that in execution.
Are they willing to go public with that?
This is the problem. That, you know, in fact, there was one state chief who Duncan was so irate at his pushback that he called the governor and essentially, essentially tattled on the chief for not being sufficiently compliant. Look, this is this bizarre situation that we've created where states are supposed to come on bended knee for a little bit of freedom from calling most of their schools failing. And in return, they've got to sign up for the administration's entire reform agenda.
Look, I don't understand why our friends in the House aren't having an oversight hearing where they call these state chiefs to testify under oath to tell them all these stories, right? I mean, then they can't be blamed for tattling on the Department of Ed. And let's hear it out. Let's hear what is going on behind these closed doors.
Yeah, but the other reality here, though, is if, you know, but these governors, right, the Christies, the Daniels, I mean, good, smart, accomplished Republican governors. This is an area where they get, you know, where they like, they like being bipartisan. Mm-hmm. And so they find it very useful and defensible to kind of bite their tongue because they're like, you know what, it's a small price to pay for having an area they can point to as bipartisan success.
All right, topic number three.
Last week, charter school officials reported that many D.C. charters have high suspension and expulsion rates, including one school that expelled 8% of its students in a single year. Does this validate critics who say charters just get rid of the most challenging students?
Look, this one school was one of the friendship schools here in town, and they've disputed the numbers. They say it's not that high. But, Rick, this has always, to me, been the strongest argument against charter schools or against school choice, is what opponents say is it's not parents choosing the schools, it's the schools choosing the kids. And, you know, this happens on special ed, it happens on the front end with the sort of kids being encouraged to apply or not. But this is an issue on the back end. Should these charter schools be allowed to kick out so many of their kids and basically send them back to the public schools?
Yes.
And, you know, why? How does that make it fair? Doesn't that then lead the public schools to be the, quote, dumping ground for the kids that nobody else wants?
It's a problem.
And how do you solve it? What do you just there say?
Is
too
no,
bad.
There
too
is.
Bad.
There's no solution to this. I mean, this is what happens when, you know, districts expel kids or suspend kids, that they wind up in remedial or, you know, alternative programs. But look, the reality is what makes charter. You tend not to see this on the National Alliance's website, admittedly. Mm-hmm. But you know, one of the things that makes charter successful is that they attract faculty that want to teach in that school. And they're serving kids and families that want to be part of that school. And this allows them to spend a lot less time, you know, wooing consensus and a lot more time just, you know, trying to educate kids effectively. Well, you know, that's part of the deal.
All right, but
schools
have to keep
kids who aren't with the mission, who don't behave.
All right, but it does sound like a double standard. And my answer is, look, I think the public schools should have a lot more leeway in kicking kids out too. I mean, and being able to say, and they do, right? They do create alternative schools and other things like that. Is to be able to say,
I mean, how many hundreds or thousands of kids does DCPS send a year to private school placements? You know, at relatively substantial cost.
Because of, you mean, emotional disturbance
special
issues?
Needs, right? Special needs. They say, yeah, we just don't have a placement in our system for them.
Right.
So here's $75,000 in taxpayer money. Take them.
Right, right. And figuring out a way for a system like D.C., now where the charters are penetrated so highly, whether the charters can be somehow be a part of that as well.
But, you know, part of what's disingenuous on the part of charter critics here is many of these charters are treating as LEAs, as local education agencies. Now, the fact that a school district, that Montgomery County or Fairfax County serves, you know, all of these children with special needs doesn't mean each and every school has those programs.
Right.
It means that county as a whole has a program at one or more sites.
Mm-hmm.
But these folks are unwilling to think of charters as part of that ecosystem. They want each and every charter to be equally able to serve each and every one of these children,
mm-hmm.
Which is, I think, also an artificially high bar.
All right. So what we need is a charter school in D.C. that's just going to take all the kicked out kids for the other charter schools. I think that would be helpful.
This is what we have, right? We did this in the early 70s. These were called alternative schools.
All right, great. That's all the time we've got now. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber Winkler's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We were just talking a little bit about management and how important management is, and Rick Wicker sharing his tips. You know, Amber and I, we're supposed to be going to a management training thing this week. Mm. I'm going by myself.
Why is not Amber going?
Oh, because Amber forgot to register.
Accidentally, kind of, sort of.
Accidentally. I think there's going to be a session on passive-aggressive employees that I'm going to listen carefully to.
Well, this is one of those, you know, you've got to model responsibility as a manager. And when you're forgetting to register for important professional development,
I know.
That's not
I did write on my
model.
Calendar, though. I just never paid.
I'm
halfway there.
We value professional development around here at Fordham. We encourage people to go to these sorts of things. Do you do that as well at AEI?
Oh, no. In fact, Rick. I'm generally down. In fact, the research of professional development is pretty uniformly stunning. We should have Amber do a meta-analysis of what we know about professional development in general.
All right. Even in any workplaces, not just education?
Yeah.
Well, I'll report next week on whether or not I learned anything from my management training.
Yeah, we'll wait with a bated breath.
All right, Amber, what you got for us this week?
This week we have the new 2012 Brown Center Report on American Education by Tom Lovelace. Three separate reports. I'm going to go quickly through them. In the first one, Lovelace rehashes the finding that the quality or rigor of standards is generally unrelated to state NAEP scores. He concludes that the Common Core standards will have little impact on achievement, which is, of course, true if they're not joined by meaningful state accountability systems, good teachers, good tests, and so on and so forth. His second report compares the main NAEP and the long-term NAEP to see if they show similar results about the extent of our achievement gap. He finds that the main NAEP data report larger gaps, especially as they relate to ELL students, than does the long-term NAEP, because they measure different constructs. Well, okay. And we should be careful when we talk about achievement data that we're talking about the right test and so on and so forth. So that was a little bit wonky, but okay. Finally, last report. It's not a study, but it's a warning in terms of how we should interpret and draw lessons from international test scores. Lovelace basically says we can't cherry pick international data for what we want them to say. Okay, that's smart. And one case study, like Finland, does not a policy make. We need to stop drawing dumb causal conclusions from PISA and TIMSS, all of which makes sense, but it read more like an op-ed to me than an empirical study that belongs in a Brown report. So there
all
you
right.
have it.
So let it be known, we love Tommy L. on this podcast. He was on the very first episode of the podcast.
Wow,
he was remote,
right?
I believe.
He was remote, an interview.
You know what he remembered he sounded like?
That's because we put a telephone on conference and put it up to the microphone, and it turned out that didn't work very well.
Our production values were limited back in the
day. Come a long
and
way.
I think he was doing half the reports when I first came to Fordham. So yes, lots of love.
That is
for
true.
Loveless.
And at least once upon a time, we used to go out to happy hour with him quite a bit. Until he stopped coming into D.C. Mm. And we stopped going to happy hours. Okay, but then, all that said, come on, Tommy L., he's phoning it in. What is this? I mean, his finding that the Common Core is not going to work? What, does he have a crystal ball? I thought the findings only happen when you do empirical studies after the fact.
Hold on, but I thought Amber...
As a prediction.
I thought Amber just pointed out that Common Core will work if you've got terrific teachers, assessment, school leaders, curriculum materials, training, and instruction. Now, I actually find that a plausible hypothesis.
Isn't that plausible?
But I'm a little befuddled about how much the Common Core matters, because if you give me terrific instruction, assessments, teachers, school leaders,
but
and the
does
rest
it not start
without
with,
Common Core?
It really does start with standards, though, doesn't it? Like, you got to have some decent, like, you know, idea of what you're supposed to be teaching. You had standards when you taught. Did you not in Baton Rouge? Did you have standards?
We may have.
May have.
Actually, you know, this is actually a classic example. You were required by the state to explain how your instruction on a given class mapped onto the state standard, you know, standards of learning.
Mm-hmm.
So what we would all do is on Sunday night when we had to file, you know, the carbon copies of our lesson plans for the week, we would just all randomly sit there for 10 minutes and kind of scribble in to make sure that we were covering, right, you know, 18, Roman numeral 18, mm-hmm, 3.2. It was a travesty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But there was one part where he's trying to say that, you know, we look at these rankings and they're inaccurate because these countries are actually in bands. And so, mm-hmm, it's not accurate to say the U.S. is number 20, let's say. He says it's more like we're number 5. But yet there's like still like 20 countries in front of us.
No, I mean, I actually thought that the third report made sense. It's common sense. Like, don't do this stuff. But it wasn't. I mean, isn't the Brown Center report supposed to be more of an empirical new research? I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. But it read like an op-ed to me. I mean, in terms of, you know, this is a good idea not to do this and that and the other.
I think the bloggy culture has finally caught up with Tom Loveless.
Mm.
Next year, they'll just call it the Brookings blog.
I mean,
it was useful. He gave a little like snap, like a little screenshot of like the, you know, a Tim's report graph, and said, "This is how you read this," you know, which is nice. That's useful.
I that's interesting. I mean, he's been doing the Brown Report for what, like 10 or 12 years
long
or
time.
More. So I'm curious. Like, I don't actually know what the mission statement is, mm-hmm, of them, or if there have been, you know, other pieces like this or not.
Okay, now Amber, it is that time for our quiz. What was the quiz from last week?
So last week you kind of had a softball. Adam was on here, so I give you guys a choice quiz. So what percentage of all public school students attend a charter school? Keep in mind, this is from 08-09. So that would be 0.7%, 7.2, 10.3, or 15.4. That was a hard one.
Oh, yeah. 0.7.
Yes. That was 43% of our.
Well, I have to mentally dial back
right.
4 academic years to see.
Exactly.
Click, 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 click.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Back to 1.1 million, back to 970,000. No, I'm just making it up.
So, what is it right now? Where are we up to at this point?
About what? 1.5%?
Yeah. I think so.
Okay.
All right. So, this week, new question. Be on the edge of your seats. What percentage of 25 to 29 year olds have attained their high school diploma? Or the GRE. This is from 2010.
GED, you mean?
GED, yeah. Sorry, what did I say? GRE.
I mean, that should count if they can pass the GRE.
How do you pass?
I don't know.
Set a cutoff score. All right, so 49%, 59, 69, or 79 are your choices. So log in to edexcellence.net/podcast.
Intriguing. I wonder what the right answer is.
Let's better spread, Amber. That's good. That's good.
Thank you.
Woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what up with that. What up with that? Yes, sir.
Chris, welcome back to the show. Are you all fired up about Linsanity, Chris? You're a sports guy.
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool. He seems like a pretty down-to-earth guy. Do you know who is really fired up about Linsanity? Is Arnie Duncan. You see that? He's been using the Edicom.
He's kind of obsessed about it.
Yeah.
Oh,
God. I feel bad for like Deron Williams or somebody who's been like a bringing it hard work and point guard for years. And
He'll get his payday this offseason.
Yeah.
Well, you also figured that at some point Jeremy Lin's just going to fall apart again. Crushed under the pressure. At least it's likely. Okay, what do you got for us this week, Chris?
Well, Mike and Rick, I'm sure you've both been here before. Michael Jackson's music comes on, the air turns electric, and one instinctively has the primal urge to bust a move, just like Mike is doing now. The arms start flailing, the legs start kicking, and inevitably a hand finds its way close to the midsection. Well, a 9-year-old student at a Catholic school in Minnesota had that impulse recently during a school-sponsored event, and let's just say it didn't end on a high note. The boy was suspended indefinitely for his performance of Billie Jean after imitating MJ's dance moves. School principal Pat Boland said the instances when the boy reached for his groin area were violations of the school's, quote, gross misconduct policy. As a frame of reference, some students at the event performed wearing underwear, while others did a dance shaking their, quote, tail feathers. So at this Catholic school, replicating the dance moves of Tom Cruise, a crazy Scientologist, and P. Diddy, artist of such songs as Ass on the Floor and Pass the Crevassier, is perfectly acceptable, but imitating the King of Pop is considered gross misconduct? What's up with that? Seriously, what kind of bias is that? According to the school's own handbook, gross misconduct is defined as, quote, conduct which creates a substantial and unjustifiable risk of harm to another person or serious damage to the property of the school or another person, or conduct which substantially impairs the discipline and order of the school environment. Look, I'm sorry, but the only way this can be construed as gross misconduct would have been if the boy severely butchered the moves of one of the greatest performers in history. But then again, the kid's 9 years old. So in reality, I'm guessing the only thing his performance could have been was hilarious and adorable.
Chris, the boy was touching his private parts. I mean, you're just saying that, you know, the Catholic Church should just look away at this? I mean, is this not a part of the war on religion that is happening across our country right now?
Look, I don't have any problem with it, Mike. If they came down harsh on it, that's fine. But let's make the policy consistent.
Chris is a stickler for consistency.
Well, I mean, if the kids who were shaking their tail feathers were grabbing the groin, although I got to say, grabbing your groin doesn't actually sound that misconducty. Grabbing your crotch,
yeah,
much more so.
Yeah.
So it depends a little bit where you're going there, but you know, I think it's hard to judge these. You know, again, A, this is a private institution, and B, we don't know the details of what went down.
Yeah. In other words, Chris, we're not going along with you on this one. I'm sorry. I like Michael Jackson, too. And may I say, I can do a pretty good Michael Jackson impersonation if you have not seen the Fordham Dance Institute video from last April Fool's Day.
What's the link for that, Mike?
I don't know, but you can probably Google it.
It's hard to find.
I grabbed my crotch during the dance, though.
No, I believe not.
All right. Well, we'll put it up on the podcast.
It's on our YouTube page.
Where the hoodie little tassels were spun.
Yeah.
That was true.
Nobody grabbed their crotch, as far as I can recall. And I don't think that's too much to ask for a 9-year-old Catholic schoolboy.
I mean, I think it'd be a lot more of a gross misconduct if, you were on the Fordham Dance Institute video grabbing your crotch versus a 9-year-old boy who hasn't hit puberty yet doing it.
Well, that's a gray area for me, Chris. I don't know. But this is what we do here at Fordham. We debate these weighty issues. Is a crotch grab by a 9-year-old gross misconduct or not? Let us know what you think. If you would like to engage with us, comment, ask questions, send us email, you can do that. You can go to the podcast page at edexcellence.net/podcast. You can also see past episodes. Please do that. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.